So, again, I would request if those hiding around the corner, anyone caught hiding will be arrested. You can sit up here, honestly, it's fine here. I know that generally. Just come and sit just there. Because the main worry is how far I can throw my voice, because we don't have a microphone. Oma gyana tibarandasya gyana gana salakaya chaksurun militamina tasmai si guruve nama Sri Chaitanya maram bhistam shapitam inam bhutale swayam rupa gadamayam dadati svam matantikam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adaita Garara Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktivrindam Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. Hare Rama, 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 Hare Hare. So, how many people know something about the Hare Krishna philosophy? Put your hand up. Okay. How many people know nothing at all, really? Don't be shy, put your hand up, because I have to gauge how I should speak. I don't want to talk and then be going too far, too deep without people knowing. So basically, the Krishna consciousness philosophy is very ancient. It's not something new. It is many, many thousands of years old, 5,000 years ago. It is called Vedanta, or Vedic knowledge. It's not Hinduism. Many people think Hinduism is a religion. Actually, there is no philosophy in the world that mentions the word Hindu. It doesn't exist. Hinduism is taken from the pronunciation of the Pathans or the Afghanis when they attacked India. They used the word Hindus. Hindus is a valley. Hindus, they couldn't pronounce the I, so they used to say H. Hence where the word Hindu came from. Vedic philosophy, the word Veda means truth. It's not a religion, as many people think in the normal sense of the word religion, because religion means a type of faith. Now, faith is changeable. You can change your faith, because faith is generally based upon a certain degree of information. And information, in the material world anyway, information tends to increase or decrease or change if it's not coming from the absolute plane. Now, there are two things described in Vedic knowledge. Actually, altogether, there are three, basically. One is that God, of course, the absolute truth. And the other two is the superior and inferior energies of God, that God has multifarious energies, because God's unlimited. So therefore, we can't say that God is in any way limited by His energy. But they're categorized into two energies. One is called the superior, and one is called inferior. Now, in the inferior energy, the nature of inferiority is that it is incomplete. Something which is incomplete. Something which is insubstantial. Which does not have a substantial content. So basically, called the limited. The material energy is called the limited energy. It's limited. It's very fascinating, it's very wonderful, it's very all-pervasive, but it actually is limited, because the material energy, by its very constitution, is created to be limited. Now, the other energy of God is called the spiritual energy, which is unlimited. So basically, God has predominantly two energies. One is limited and one is unlimited. And in the Vedic teachings, the Bhagavad Gita, which is in front of me here, Lord Krishna explains that actually the living entity belongs, the spirit soul belongs to the superior energy. He belongs to the unlimited. His nature is to be attracted to the unlimited. You see? And at the moment, the living entity is encased, or if you like, he is covered over by the inferior limited energy. So the Gita is explaining that there's a problem. The problem is that something superior has taken residence inside something inferior. That's a big problem. Because if the nature of superiority is predominant, and the only thing that the superior energy can acquaint itself with is inferior, this is called incompatible relationship. Just like we see it in this world, someone who's got a superior intelligence doesn't like to mix with someone of an inferior intelligence. Someone who's got superior wealth doesn't like to mix with people who haven't got any wealth. Somebody who's very beautiful doesn't like necessarily to hang out with people that are very ugly. Someone who is educated and intelligent, sophisticated, so birds of a feather tend to flock together. We tend to see that everyone is almost magnetically attracted to a superior thing. Just like when you go out shopping, you don't go out to buy an inferior product. How many people go shopping looking for the most inferior product they can find on the market? Isn't it? You go out because you want to find superior product for your money. So the general tendency, psychological tendency, is towards superiority. And we see that particularly in the human existence, human form of life, human beings are naturally inclined towards superior development. This is called economic development. We go to school, to college, we go to university because we want to increase. We are always trying to increase. We want to improve our situation. And in order to do that, we are very, very busy manipulating material energy. Actually, from the moment we come into this world to the moment we go out, we generally are involved with making adjustments. If you study the whole thing of adjustment, it's very wonderful because you'll find that you accept things because there's no choice a lot of the times. Just like your body is a good example. We've all got body. Everyone in this room's got a different type of body. Some of us have a little bit more beauty than the other. Some of us are a little bit more intelligent than the other. Some of us are a little bit more famous than the other. Some of us are a little bit more stronger than the other, or whatever. But all of us that are in this body, none of us are perfectly... Is anyone there who's perfectly satisfied with their body? Is anyone that could actually say, well, I never want anything added? You see? But at the same time, if you knew that you could achieve a more perfect state than the one you're in, then naturally we all would be attracted to that superior state. Now, the Vedic literature explains that the living entity actually belongs to a superior plane, because each one of us, we are part of God. By our very qualities, each one of us, we have the quality of God, but we don't have the quantity. You see, consciousness is actually coming from superior dimension. And this can be very logically explained. It's not something sentimental, because many people, they use the word soul, but they don't really know what soul means. What is a soul? I mean, what does it look like? What does it do? Where is it? So it's one thing to use the word soul, but it's another thing to actually try to understand what is the soul. You see, the nature of soul can be studied if you realize that one thing is that your body is made up of inanimate substances. And there is also animation in your body. Just like your body has what we call consciousness. When your body is dead, suppose you take a dead body, the thing which has left the body is called consciousness. Now consciousness, according to Vedic literature, comes from the soul, just as light comes from the sun. If you go out, you'll see light. Sunshine is coming from the sun. Now, in one sense, sunshine is the sun, and it's not the sun. You know, just like you can have sunshine in your room, but you can't say the sun is in your room. That would be a bit of an exaggeration. So in the same way, consciousness is pervading throughout the body. It's pervading throughout the body. You have consciousness throughout your body. But at the same time, consciousness is not the body. It's not the body. It's actually what it is. It's very similar that if you put on a coat, suppose you put on an overcoat and then under that you put on a shirt or a jumper or something like that. So although the coat, you may say, as an example, when you're walking down the road, the coat is walking down the road. And that's true, isn't it? But actually, coats don't walk. So when you further make an analysis of the situation, you realize that actually it's not the coat that's walking. It's the person in the coat that has activated the coat, brought the coat to life. In other words, the coat has two arms because the person needs to put his two arms inside the coat. It's not that you create a coat and then you create a human being to put him inside it, is it? So therefore, the external form in the material world, we all have forms. Now, in the Bible, it also says that God created man to his own liking and his own image. That's very important to understand, because the imagery or the form of humans, they are a perverted reflection of the superior form. In other words, what we see in the material world is reality reflected in illusion. Reality does exist, just like the tree on the bank of a river is the reality. But when it's reflected in the water, the tree is also in the water. Have you ever gone along a bank of a river? It's also got a tree in the water, but the tree that's in the water is not substantial. You couldn't go picking fruits. I mean, if you jumped in the water to get a few apples, people would think you're totally crazy. Because the substance that the tree is reflected upon is not substantial to produce fruit. So in the same way, form exists originally in the spiritual world. God is the supreme embodiment of form. Form comes from personality. Just like each one of you, you are individual, distinct personalities. No two people in this room are the same. You may have a chemical similarity, but you don't have the same personality. You've got your individual tastes and choice. You've got your individual mental, psychological makeup, physical makeup. But at the same time, the wonderful thing about you and every other single creature on the planet is you've all got individuality. Now, what is the particular nature of individuality is the display of independence. You've all got independence. Each one of you is free. You're a free agent. Because you study consciousness, you'll find that consciousness always wants to be free. You say, just like, for instance, a tree has also got consciousness, but it's very dull. Now, if you put a tree in a room, it'll stay there for 500 years. Or 100 years. But at the same time, if you bring higher levels of consciousness, like a human or even an animal, it won't like to stay there very long. It automatically wants to move, because the nature of consciousness is dynamic. Consciousness actually is dynamic because God is infinitely dynamic. The nature of God is that He is unlimitedly dynamic. That's why when you think of God, I mean, I'll give an example. Suppose after all you're going to church and doing all your prayers and you're bowing down and you finally got to the pearly gates, they opened wide and there was God. And he just caught arthritis and he was humping along with a walking stick and he came up and said, "Oh, it's getting terrible up here. I tell you, I don't know if I can handle it anymore. Can you take over?" You see, you'd be kind of disappointed, wouldn't you? After all that praying and worshiping and reverence and everything else, it turned out that he's got problems. And you turn around and say, "Well, I've been going to you for years, giving you all my problems. And I find out you've got as many as I have. More." So you'd be disappointed, you see, because actually everybody knows that God should at least have something more than we've got. Now, the idea of God in most people's mind is that God is some sort of energetic force, because we see displays of energy. We see lightning and thunder and the sun and the moon and the stars, and we see all this cosmic sort of stuff going on, and we think, yes, God must have a bit of energy about him, you see? But at the same time, Vedic literature has explained that this energy we see here is only a very small portion of God's energy. And then this energy is his separated energy. God has a separated energy. Now, how do you explain a separated energy? Because I'll give you an example. The nature of the individual is independence. So just like in society, they have a society. Dublin is a society. But we also have a prison. Within that society, unfortunately, there's a prison. Now, the prison is also part of Dublin. But Dublin prison is not where everyone comes. All the tourists don't come to stay in a prison in Dublin. You see, because what is the nature of a prison is it makes you very limited, doesn't it? If you go to prison, you become very limited. You have to get up at a certain time, go to bed at a certain time, you can't watch telly at a certain time, you can't actually just go out and, you know, go to the disco, you can't have girlfriends, you can't have so many things. So the nature of prison is that it's more limited than Dublin itself. It's part of Dublin, but it's much more limited than Dublin. So similarly, within God's energies, there is an energy called the inferior energy, where all of the individual part and parcels of God, the spirit soul, come here. They come to the material world in order to exercise their minute independence. Now, our independence is only microscopic in comparison to God. But at the same time, because we have independence, we have been given the facility within the material world to exercise that independence. And therefore, Vedic literature is explained that when the living entity comes into the material world, he tries to actually imitate God. Even though we don't even know what God is, so it's kind of ludicrous to say, how could I be imitating someone I don't even know? Most people will bring that argument. You can imitate Billy Clinton or something, because at least you've got an idea what he does. You know, you could dress up, make up as him, and stand in front of a mirror and give a speech to the Congress or something. But how do you imitate God when you don't even know what God is? But you do know what God is because you're part of God. You are intrinsically part of God. Therefore, you've naturally got the same propensities that God has. The only thing is that your propensities are manifested in a perverted way. Now, Krishna conscious philosophy explains that actually God, the nature of God, is that he's a person. The word used in Sanskrit language is Bhagavan. Bhagavan means that he is the possessor of all Bhagavan. Sorry, Van means opulence. God has unlimited opulence. Now, what is the nature of us in the material world? We're all looking for some opulence, isn't it? We all like to have a bit of money in our pocket and say, hey, listen, here's a few hundred, go and enjoy yourself, isn't it? Or big house, big car, a very beautiful body, nice looking face, all the girls look at me, they swoon when they look at me, they swoon, isn't it? They don't just look at me, they swoon, some of them faint. That's the nature of the material world. When the false ego, what we call the egocentric consciousness, when it's mixed up with matter, it becomes manifested through three different qualities. They are called sattvam, rajas, tamayati, goodness, passion, and ignorance. They're mixed up, just like you take colors. You have, say, yellow, red, and blue. And you mix them all up. You come with infinity of different shades and different types of variations. But the original substance is there. So similarly, the material world has three qualities: goodness, passion, and ignorance. And the nature of goodness is It's like this, if you like to try and understand an example, that God is light in the sense that the spiritual world has full, unlimited qualities. The more you become degraded in the material energy, the more those qualities become more and more reduced. So what happens is that the tendency towards human beings in the human form of life is we have an attraction towards goodness. Just like you see any religion. The leader of that religion, as an example, say, because most people are acquainted with Christianity, Jesus Christ, you automatically think of Jesus Christ very compassionate, very humble, very tolerant, self-controlled. He had vast knowledge, beauty, whatever, so many different qualities. And these qualities are the opulence. They are the opulence. Quality, because God is a person, we are a person. So naturally, there's a question of quality. When you have a person, you have the quality of the person, isn't it? It's not just good enough that you're a person, but how good are you as a person? What is your quality? So therefore, when we're interacting with each other, we're looking for the quality. Quality of consciousness. Now, what happens is when the spirit soul comes into the material world, because its consciousness is very minute, very small, it becomes covered over by ignorance. Ignorance is the all-pervading nature of matter. And within that ignorance, there is the possibility of the tiny living entity thinking that somehow or other that he's in control of matter. That I actually have some control over matter. So therefore, Shakespeare put it very nicely, that the world is but a stage, and everyone who comes here, there are different types of actors. Some people is acting out the big policeman thing, you know, controlling over citizens. Someone else is acting out that he's a big movie rock star. Someone else is acting out that he's a mathematician or a logician or a scientist or a teacher. Someone else is acting out that he's a great football player or a piano player or a dancer or some sort of, businessman, merchant, banker. So many different types of acts, really. Now, why do we call them acts? Because an act is something that you put on, but it doesn't last. You see, what happens if you look at an actor when he goes on a stage, his performance is according to the props, according to the environment that he's putting on his act. So therefore, if you're doing King Lear or something like that in a Shakespearean production with huge money spent on it, you can do an enormous sort of display. But if you're doing a little backstreet theater in some housing estate and there's not even a curtain, what to speak of a stage, then your performance is not going to be that great. So what happens is that in the material world, material energy is created by God. Man proposes and God disposes. The material energy reciprocates with our desire. According to our desire, because material energy is non-different from God, it is the energy of God, so it works according to God's direction. But according to the individual capacity or activity, what we call in Vedic literature is karma. For every action you do, there is an opposite and equal reaction. Now, if you perform activities which are beneficial, in other words, good activities, you get a good reaction. If you perform activities which are exploitive, passionate activities, you get a passionate reaction. And if you perform activities which are ignorant and misguided, you get an ignorant reaction. So basically, Vedic literatures explain that all of these different types of bodies that you see, they are all interaction between what is the senses and the objects of the senses. The senses is the material body. Your body is made up of senses. And what is the business of bodies? The business of bodies is to be busybodies. Isn't it? We're all busybodies. We come here to be busybodies. But the nature of our busyness is we want to create an environment that our senses can be happy, our senses can get pleasure. Basically, we are pleasure-seeking entities. We want pleasure, and we want lots of it, loads of it. We want oceans of the stuff. We don't just want a little piece of pleasure now and again. What's the use of that? You see? What we want is, by nature, we are attracted to the unlimited. We want unlimited pleasure. But the problem is that in the material world, we are not capable, on account of our disqualification, we are not capable of squeezing out of the material world sufficient happiness. It's not that we didn't try. We've tried everything. Most people throughout their lifetime, they try so many different types of sensual activity. Some people spend hours in a pub knocking back pint after pint of this grey stuff, thinking that the next one's going to do it. The other 50,000 didn't, but this one's really going to do it. This one's going to give me a kick that I never knew before. I'm going to start seeing, hallucinating and everything. So the nature is that with the senses, the very nature of senses, because the senses belong to the spiritual plane, they do not belong to the material plane. Just like when the soul leaves the body, there's no more sensual activity. You don't see the same guy down the pub when he's dead. You don't see the same person sitting in a restaurant with his wife when he's dead. You know? So therefore, you can understand that actually, as long as the soul, as long as consciousness is in the body, there is always the activity of sensuality. But really, you see, sensuality requires superior phenomena. In the material world, the phenomena, I'll give you an example, that really, if you study it in a sort of more esoteric way, but there's basically three things going on in your body. There's you. You're the I. Then there's the instruments by which you observe phenomena. Because you're in there. I mean, you may not know where you are, but you are in there. And then you're observing the material world through your eyes, through your nose, through your mouth, through your ears, through your sense of touch. These things are bringing in, you're all the time bringing in information to inform, to hear, to see, to touch, to smell, to taste. So, in the material world, we are always trying to increase the superiority of smell, of taste, of touch, of feel. And then we have the sense within, which is the mind. The mind is called the sixth sense within. The mind is trying to search on a higher plane, because the mind is of a subtle nature. It tends to actually go searching for higher forms of stimulation. So therefore, on the mental plane, we are trying to bring in music, culture, arts, sciences, literature, philosophy. So many different things are coming on in the subtle plane. But all the things, if you notice, we're all bringing things from the outside to the inside. Now, what Krishna consciousness is teaching is that actually the spirit soul belongs on the spiritual plane. That actually in the material world, we are only here for a very temporary amount of time. We come into the world at a certain time. Everyone in this room came in at a certain time. Is anyone who's been here a long, 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 long time, like a few thousand years or anything? Am I making any mistakes here? Has anyone been here over 100 years? So we come in. Everyone comes in at a certain time. Some of us were born in the 50s, some were in the 60s, some were in the 70s. And every one of us will go out at a certain time. So the material world, in a sense, is like a big, if you could give an example, that this planet is like a big hotel floating in space. And we've kind of popped in from somewhere. We went about a whole load of activities, most of them very funny kind of activities. But anyway, we went through a whole load of activities, like sitting in front of a television for 100 hours a week, things like that. Things which are totally, I'm sure if we were observed by some aliens, they'd think, what do these people do all day? They look at this box. But the point is, we did all these things, and basically we go out the other side. We come in like you do to a hotel. Now, if you come into a good hotel, like the Hilton or something, then there's loads of facilities. You've got video things and televisions and saunas and spas and restaurants, and you can go scuba diving, and they take you mountain climbing, and they do all sorts of things. But if you're like a lot of people, you're on a real budget, and you get this like mingy little hotel, cockroaches flying all over the place when you're trying to take rest, and rats running around and things like that, then you feel thoroughly miserable. So the happiness and the stress of the material world is relative to the type of body that we get. Because you come into the world, you're born into a certain family, you didn't choose who your parents were. Nobody can say, yes, well, that was mom and dad that I picked. I remember I had a photo album, I said, yeah, I want this mom, I want that dad, I want this kind of environment. No, we're born into a certain family, we grow up in that family, and we engage in various activities, which all of them are because of certain conditions. I'm born in Ireland, I grow up as an Irish person. You don't find anyone in Ireland growing up as a German, do you? So you are born into certain conditions. Now, what does the word condition mean? It means something which is imposed upon you. It's not what you chose. You may say, okay, well, it's not that bad, I accept it. Just like when you came in this room, there's certain conditions. Now, as long as you've agreed to be in the room, you have to tolerate the conditions. If it's cold, it's cold. If it's hot, it's hot. If you get a meal, you get a meal. If people are nasty to you, or whatever, you may want to leave the room. That's about the most adjustment you can make. So, similarly, when we come into the material world, we come in here and we are born into certain conditions. We grow up in those conditions, and we die in those conditions. The basic principle of the material world is birth, old age, disease, and death. You get born, you grow, the nature of any matter, doesn't matter whether you're human or a flower or a cockroach or a mouse or a cat. The nature of matter is it's born at a certain time, it grows for some time, it produces some byproducts, it stays for some time, it gradually dwindles for some time, and it vanishes. Anything. Whatever is created within this material environment is subject to the six principles of transformation. So this is called the transitory transformable energy of God. Now the soul belongs to the eternal, non-transformable, non-changeable. The soul, actually, the nature of the soul is nitya. Nitya nityanam chaitanya chaitananam. The nature of the soul is that we are all eternal. We have nothing to do with temporary environment. We have nothing to do because the very nature is that I want to exist. Just like I've got this body now, and the body is getting into middle age, old age. But me, I want to exist. I'm the same occupant that was there when I was a young little baby. When you've got a little baby body, I was in that little baby body going, mummy, mummy, feed me, mummy, get me this, mummy, get me that. Then when I went to school, I had this little schoolboy body. Where's it gone? I like that body. I really liked it. But suddenly, I'm in a youth body. And then I've got this young teenager body, and I've got all these things going on, discos and music and Jimi Hendrix or whatever, all this stuff going on, and suddenly that's gone. Then I've got a wife and the kids and the mortgage and the bills and this thing and that thing. And then suddenly even that's gone. Then I've got this old body, and I'm sitting in the geriatric ward or whatever, talking to the old Fred who fought with the Crimean and this and that and the other. So we are constantly travelers. We're not actually staying in one place. We are just travelers. Matter is actually transforming and changing according to the influence of that big thing called time. Time I am, Krishna says. I am the changer and destroyers of everything. So the difference between the material world and the spiritual world is that in the spiritual world, time is eternal. It is eternal. It does not shift according to what we call the enforced laws of nature. So Vedic literature has explained that Krishna, the word Krishna means all attractive. that God is all attractive. He has an all attractive personality. Basically, God is beautiful. But not anything you've seen in the material world. It's not a thing that we are not trying to extract some imagination from matter, anthropomorphic, and transfer it to the spiritual. That would be useless, because it would be just a dream world. No, we're talking about scientific understanding that God, unless God is unlimitedly beautiful, that means He's not actually God. Because that would mean that beauty would be something that God doesn't have. That would make Him inadequate. But God is complete. That means when we say complete, that God is complete, that means He has everything within our experience, and He has everything outside of our experience. Complete means that when we use the word absolute, that God contains every single thing that we can experience. Actually, all of this energy that you're seeing, it is actually coming from the mind of God. Just like we are little gods. So, give you an example. I want to create an environment, so mentally I think, okay, I want a semi-detached house, I want two bedrooms, I want this, I want that. So I get an architect, I design it, I create it, and that's my environment. I have a creative ability. I have a creative ability because God has the same creative ability. But the problem is, my ability to create is very tiny. God's ability to create is unlimited. And God, Krishna, He created all of us. Why? Because He created us so as that we could enjoy with Him in the unlimited environment of the spiritual world. Now someone may say, well, why do we leave there if it was so good? Or why do we end up here? Because the unique thing of love is that it must come from voluntary surrender. Love is something that cannot be imposed or forced or coerced in any single way. Just like if you fall in love with someone, it wasn't because they beat you up and they took a gun and said, listen, if you don't love me, I'm going to blow your brains out, or something like that. We love because it's a spontaneous really understand. Now, the nature of God is that He is the supreme lover. He is the supreme lover. That doesn't mean He's like some Casanova that you met down the pub on Saturday night. Lover means that God, the energy of God is love. Pure, unadulterated love. Just like here in the material world, the energy is hostile. Matter is actually against the principle of love. Because here in the material environment, the principle of matter, the principle of the material world, from the human kingdom to the animal kingdom, is exploitation. In the material world, the living entity, the pure soul, the pure consciousness, has a tendency to exploit. That's why we see that everyone has the intrinsic desire to exploit. Exploitation. If you go out and if you don't believe me, go on the Saturday shopping and see how people are zooming around with their eyes into every single shop, every nook, every cranny, every single thing. The boy is eyeing up the girl is eyeing up the boy, someone else is eyeing up someone's wallet, someone else is eyeing up someone's shopping basket, someone else is what? We're like, if you like to look at it in a mechanistic sort of way, we're sort of zooming around with eyes and ears and nose and tongues and touch. And we're consumers in the true sense of the word. We are always consuming things to bring things into our service. We want things to serve us. That's where envy comes from. We want things to serve us. Now, the nature of the spiritual world is the complete opposite. The nature of the spiritual world is dedication. God's only business, both in the material world and the spiritual world, is actually to serve us. Because everything you get on this planet comes from God. You didn't create milk, sugar, fruits, vegetables. You didn't create, if you study, modern science always, of course, wants to take credit for enormous advancements. But can the scientists even create one pea? You see? We didn't create the sunshine, we didn't create the rain, we didn't create the moon, we didn't create the stars, we didn't even create our own bodies.
So, the study of God is to understand that actually, God is the supreme provider. He is constantly serving us. He is serving us 24 hours a day. He never gives up that service even for one moment. So, the nature of the living entity in its pure consciousness is to serve God. That's our nature. Now, what is service? Of course, service in the material world, because people exploit in the material world, therefore we see service as a weakness. If you're nice to people in the material world, it's actually sometimes seen as a weakness. Isn't it? It's an amazing factor. But if you actually go to people and want to render them, suppose I came up to you in the middle of the street and said, "Can I serve you? Please, will you let me serve you?" You think this guy said, "No, he's mad. Or he wants to get my wallet. Or he wants to cheat me. Or he wants to do something aggressive or hostile to me," isn't it? You can't believe that someone could spontaneously want to serve you. Why? Because you're so busy exploiting everything that you can't imagine that this guy's going to give up his time exploiting, or this woman's going to give up her time exploiting, so that she can serve your exploitations. So therefore, in the material world, we make agreements. Isn't it? It's all a kind of agreed system that, you know, I'll have a relationship with you as long as you live up to my expectations that I want to extract from you. And this goes on, of course, in a subtle plane. No one likes to admit it. People get married, they fall in love with each other, head over heels, and all the rest of it. But as soon as the other person doesn't live up to the quality of sense gratification that they wanted, they get rid of them. Bye bye. Papa darling, I love you so much. No, no, I'm sorry. You gotta go. You're out. Pack your bags, away you go. Guy's crying his eyes out, jumps off a bridge or something. But she's got another one, or he does it. So we see that in the material world, unfortunately, love is something which does not really manifest in the proper sense of the word. Of course, there are cases, many, many cases of what we would call a very pure kind of love between a mother and a child, as an example, is a good example. But the science of Vedic philosophy is that actually all of us are lovers of God. Our natural tendency is to love God. Now, when we say love of God, it is not something artificial, some sort of, ritualistic, obscure kind of things that we do. Love of God is in the heart of everyone. It will gush out like an ocean. It will come out like an ocean. Because actually, the living entity, although he's infinitesimal in size, that does not mean that he lacks in plentitude. Actually, he is unlimited in his relationship with the unlimited. So as an example, a spark of fire may be a very tiny spark of the fire, but when the spark of fire is reunited with the whole fire, it comes in its fullness. It can burn down an entire city. But when the minute spark of fire is separated from the whole fire, it can't even light a piece of grass. So, the infinitesimal living entity, the soul, when he's separated from God, he is very, very incapable, pathetic. Because actually that separation from the whole is called what we call a limited conditioned state of existence. When this minute living entity in his conditional state of existence independently and voluntarily admits to the higher principle that God is in control of everything, that God is the supreme creator, the supreme enjoyer, that he is the supreme source and cause of all causes, then that tiny little living entity can actually be reunited in the unlimited environment of the spiritual world. That is called Goloka, Vrindavan. So therefore, Krishna consciousness is not a negative philosophy. Give up this, give up that, hide in a closet and grow a big beard or something like that. Krishna consciousness is a science of understanding, basically, that everything created by God belongs to God. It's His property. Basically, we come here, we borrow a few things. I mean, when you came into the world, you came in naked. You didn't bring a towel with you. Did you? Did anyone bring a toothpaste when they came in? You didn't bring anything in with you. And everything you've gotten here, you've gotten it because it exists. Not because you had it. Just like if you were sitting with your mom as a baby and you suddenly pulled out a nappy and said, I brought one with me, mom. No. You got it because it exists here. And it existed before you came in. And it will exist when you go out. That same substance that you utilized while you're here, it will still be here when you're long and gone and buried. You see? Just like this city of Dublin. So how many generations and generations of people have come here and gone? Dublin still is here. You see? And similarly, so many houses where people live, they've come and lived in the house and gone. It's still there. So the point is that Krishna consciousness means to utilize all of God's energy for His pleasure in a completely personal way. God is not impersonal. He's not something gloomy or sort of vague. He's very, very real. He's more real than one can imagine because He has form and He sits within the heart. God is situated in the heart of each one of us. He is directing the wandering of everyone. And that is called conscience. Conscience is the manifestation of God's energy within the heart. So that's conscience is telling you. It is giving you direction. But unfortunately, we tend to ignore. So the Krishna consciousness philosophy is very simple. That the soul is in great need, in great want to be reunited with God. And this process is extremely simple. Suppose Mick goes out of the room and I want to be reunited with him. And I'm crying my eyes out. My heart's broken. Mick's gone out of the room. I can't tolerate it. He's been away 5 minutes. What's the easiest thing for me to do is just go, Mick, come back. Isn't it? It's as easy as that. It's as easy as that to communicate with God. The only thing you need to do with God is talk to Him. You need to talk to God. Because the point is that you may say, well, I'd feel a bit silly, you know, because I'd be talking and where is he? You know? But the fact of the matter is that if you realize, if you're convinced that God actually does exist, then God will be there. But God will never interfere with your independence because if He interferes, then that would amount to slavery. It would amount to the fact that you are a slave of God. You're not a slave of God. You're a servant of God. There's a big difference between a slave and a servant. Because a man and a woman serve each other, but they're not slaves to each other. A slave is something which has to function according to the command of the master. So therefore, the reason that you can't see God at the moment is because basically, due to past activities, due to the past karmic contamination of the heart, you don't want to speak to Him. Most people don't really want to be face to face with God because the thing is that we are always worried that if we become face to face with God, we may end up, this is the fear of most people, we may end up finding out that actually we are His servant and we actually do have to serve Him out of love. But in Krishna consciousness, it is a very dynamic process, it is a very joyful process, it is very satisfying to the heart. And how can you prove that? How can you prove it? Because most people say, okay, come on, I serve my cat, you serve God, or I serve my wife, you serve God. What is the difference? The difference is that you will be able to give up everything. You will be able to give up everything which is not related to God. A devotee can automatically, without any effort, give up smoking, drinking, all sorts of distractions like, discotheques and pubs and clubs. He can give up any kind of television or cinema or any of these kind of things. He doesn't need to listen to what the latest beats are going. And it's not artificial. It's not that devotees are in some sort of enclosed environment and they can't go out. Actually, we are encouraged to mix completely with everyone in society. We are eager to do that. We will come to your homes if you want. If you have a room, they will stay with you for a few days. Whatever you want. We're not fearful of the environment. What we're saying is that when you get a taste for Krishna, when you get a taste of love of God, everything else will pale into insignificance. Because after all, the inferior energy, when it is actually put in front of the superior energy, it's like putting darkness in front of sunshine. What happens if you take darkness and put it in front of sunshine? It disappears. So when you take the inferior energy and you compare it with the superior energy of the spiritual world, it becomes totally insignificant. And we have proof. All of these great souls that you see here, they are all proven examples of the potency. There's personalities there that their whole life was spent in total God consciousness. They are able to communicate with God completely. We have practical. I can tell you so many things they did, but that would be a long story. But the point is, we have practical example of great souls who have achieved that state. And it is feasible, practical, in every way. It is very, very real. It is not something simply philosophical and something theoretical. So what I'm going to do now is ask for questions. Anybody have any questions, please ask. Don't feel shy, because I could go on and on and on. Everyone start falling asleep or something. So if you have questions, please ask. Challenge, even if you don't agree with something. The whole point of the talk was to give an outline. The bottom line is that the human form of life, or the particular state we're in now, this human existence, is not meant for exploiting the material senses with the material objects, but it is actually meant for reawakening our love of God through the process of Krishna consciousness. And that process of Krishna consciousness is very simple. It is chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and utilizing all of God's energy in God's service. So that you can fall in love with God. Why do you serve? Why does a man serve his wife? Because he loves his wife. Why does he serve his children? Because he loves his children. Why does he serve his country? Because he loves his country. Now all of those things, your wife, your children, your country, they will only stay for a very short period of time. But if you somehow or other utilize this time you have now to develop love for God, then that will stay with you eternally. It will be for your eternal benefit. As Christ said, what benefit a man who gaineth the whole world but loses the eternity of the soul? There's no benefit. So we're trying to say is that we're not saying you stop what you're doing. We're saying you add something. You add this concept that actually God is a person. You can worship Him directly. You can actually develop your love for God through this very sublime process of chanting the names of God and understanding the science of God through Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. It's all right. Any other questions? If we go back to Godhead, will we be fulfilled? Okay, that's a very good question. What's your name?
Carol.
Carol asked a very nice question. If we go back to Godhead, would we be fulfilled in all of our opulences or aspirations or desires or whatever? You see, this is one way which intelligently you can understand that how the two energies work, because the very nature of the soul is to be perfect. According to Vedic literature, God is perfect and everything He creates is perfect. So we are all complete, perfect individuals. But at the moment, we are associating with the imperfect environment, the limited environment. Now, when we go back to the spiritual world, when we go back to our real home, it's not something which is new, it's something which is our real home, then automatically we become part of God's pleasure. In other words, God's environment. You see, it's like this. Suppose, for instance, you live in a sort of little bedsit in the middle of London or Dublin or whatever. But suddenly you fell in love with the king of Saudi Arabia. And he just whisked you away there to Saudi Arabia, and there's palaces and big cars and whatever. You automatically become part of his uplands. Because you become part of his family, if you like. So we originally belong to God's family. We belong to the spiritual world. We become disassociated with that. As soon as we go back, we automatically enter into the unlimited environment. Unlimited bliss, unlimited knowledge, unlimited, consciousness. So the nature of the soul is to have unlimited consciousness, unlimited knowledge. He is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge, in a perfect spiritual form. Now, the thing is that the spiritual world is not just some sort of garden like you have in some religions where you go there and there's loads of apples and oranges and you pick away there and you get a few little wings and totter around. The actual spiritual world is God. There's no difference between the creation of God and God. You see, if you look into the word absolutism, there's no duality of the spiritual world. In other words, there's no separation between God's environment and God. So really, the thing about God's creation and spiritual world is that it's full of variegatedness. Variety is the spice of life. So the variegatedness of the spiritual world is of a complete and perfect, unlimited nature. So in the material world, the environment is of a complete, limited, miserable nature. The thing is that it's not a question of first or seconds. Again, you see, this is in the material world, there is what we call duality. The duality of the material world is higher and lower. Hot, cold, happiness, distress, loss, gain, victory, defeat. These are all the dualities. In the spiritual world, there is no competition. There is no, in the sense of the competing with one, I want to be number one or number two. There is no, exploitive mood there. So actually, the nature of the spiritual world is that God is enjoying giving love and pleasure to His devotees. And the devotees are enjoying unlimitedly giving love and pleasure to God. Any other questions, or we'll get ready to stop?
Could you explain how something limited or inferior can come from?
Yeah, how can something inferior and limited come from the superior and unlimited? The thing is that again, going back to the example of the prison within the city, a prison is a building created by the government. It's not separate from the government, but it's created for an inferior purpose. It's created to keep rebellious antisocial personalities locked up. So in one sense, you can't say the prison is inferior because it belongs to the government, and then you'd be saying that the government's inferior. What it is that the function is inferior. Actually, the material world is not inferior because we can see that there's so much superior arrangement within the material world, but the function is to keep the rebellious living entities in a confined environment of three dimensions. In other words, we have been brought into the cubicle because we misbehave. We've been brought into this limited environment, time and space. So we are living in a three-dimensional prison house, which is controlled by time and space. Just like a prison. It's a limited creation within the city in order to confine antisocial rebellious personalities to a limited dimension controlled by time and space. What is it when you get a sentence? You get a certain amount of time, isn't it? They even use that for criminals. Say, oh, I got more time. I'm put down for time. My time is 10 years, 5 years, 3 years. And they're put into a certain space. So when we come into the material world, we come into the limited time, for a limited time and space, but that one should not understand that that is inferior. Actually, to create a prison is sometimes very, very difficult, because you need electronic doors, you need all sorts of electronic fences, you need wonderful kind of, cameras, and you need all sorts of doors that open with little remote controls. So it's not that inferior. Actually, prisons are sometimes more complex than even people's houses. But the point is that the function is inferior. It's not wanted. People don't want to have prisons in society. But unfortunately, when there is misuse of the freedom, then we find ourselves put into that environment.
So it's not a prison in the way it is.
We're here because basically we have a desire to imitate God. Exactly. Yeah, the word is better if it's used as transmigration. Transmigration means when you are transitory, moving from one body to another. In this lifetime, you also had a completely different body. You see, the word transmigration, as I said, it's basically, it's not a question of coming back. It's a question of moving from one particular type of body to another. When you were a 3-month-old baby, then you're a 1-year baby, you're a 5-year, you're a 10-year, you're a 15-year, you're 30. The body changes every 8 years completely, utterly changes, every chemical in the body. So what happens is that when this body becomes no longer valid, when it becomes invalid, invalidated, then you give it up. It's like a coat. You buy a nice new coat, you show it off to all your friends, the neighbors, everyone. You say, look at this coat, isn't it fantastic? But then when it gets raggedy and useless, you throw it away or give it to the Salvation Army or whatever you do. So the point is that matter is a usable item. It's usable, we use it, but then it has the unfortunate thing that it deteriorates with time. So therefore, this body, when it deteriorates with time, then by the laws of nature, we change it. We give up the old and we move into a new. According to our consciousness at the time of death, we will get a particular type of matter that we are actually qualified to get. Matter means skin, bone, mucus, pus, stool, urine, blood, veins, and a few bones chucked in. That's what we get, basically. Now, if you're a mouse, you've got skin, bone, mucus, stool, bile, and air. And if you're a cockroach or whatever, you've got the same. We're stopping now, by the way. Everyone's rushing out. You see? You ask too many questions. You going to take a little feast before you go? We're going to be serving some very nice... Oh, what a shame. I didn't know you had to leave. Can you give him some prasadam? Thank you. All right, we better start chanting and have the feast before everyone leaves. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.